Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Manny Eck.
A new movie starring Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep tells the story of one boy's journey from a dystopian society.
Who are you?
The Giver. When the elders need guidance, I provide wisdom using memories of the past. Our world was different. There was more.
More?
Much more.
Do you love chocolate? Did you know it can be good for you?
What's not to love about a bassoon?
You find double reeds in pop music, you find them in jazz, you find them all over the place, and a lot of times sprinkled in such a way that people don't even recognize that they're there.
Thousands of people have been crossing the U.S. border, but it's a perilous trip.
A new book looks at extreme life in the sea.
And we'll mark a special anniversary. That's all coming up on this Monday edition of Now. A new movie starring Oscar winners Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep, The Giver, tells the story of a young boy who faces some hard choices in order to change his world.
The movie tells the story of Jonas, who lives in a place called the Community, where there's no war, no suffering, and no hunger. But there's also no color or love.
Jonas is chosen to be the receiver of memories, where he will learn both the good and bad memories of his society.
Leading Jonas on this journey is a man known as The Giver, played by Jeff Bridges.
They're called books.
Hello? My name...
I know who you are.
Who are you?
The Giver. When the elders need guidance, I provide wisdom using memories of the past. Our world was different. There was more.
More?
Much more.
When Jonas learns the Community engineered a society of sameness to protect its people, he wants to leave it and go to a place called Elsewhere.
One aspect of the Community is its releasing of those who are not the same, including infanticides of twins. Jonas and the Giver understand that the Community must change, that it must have its memories return. The only way to do that is for Jonas to leave.
The Community is controlled by the elders who oversee every aspect of life. Meryl Streep plays the chief elder.
You're being careless. You're moving too fast. We both know what happened 10 years ago with the girl.
The girl had a name.
You think I don't remember?
I know you feel her loss.
The boy must hold in the pain. Don't fail us again.
Jonas' original plan is changed when he learns that a baby he has grown to love is set to be released. He escapes with the baby, and their dangerous adventure begins.
Jeff Bridges both produced and stars in the movie. He says he wanted to turn the story, originally a book by Lois Lowry, into a movie for years.
I found it also was quite controversial. It was also on the banned books list. And I thought, well, that's okay. You know, this is the kind of movie I'd like to see, kind of edgy and... But it took us 18 years to finally get it up on the screen.
At the New York premiere, Meryl Streep told the Associated Press that she wanted to do the movie because she wanted to work with Bridges.
I wanted to do it because I wanted to work with Jeff. I've always wanted to work with him. And he's such a beautiful, soulful actor. And this part asks everything of him that he has in his long career. So I'm just lucky I got in at this moment.
Katie Holmes plays Jonas's mother, who lacks empathy and works for the Department of Justice in the Community. She said at the premiere that the film hits on several universal themes.
Well, I think the themes of conformity versus individualism, I think Jonas's discovery of humanity at his young age, and the fact that it's really a story about hope is what makes people really connect to it.
Brenton Thwaites plays Jonas. He says this film is different from other films in the same genre, like The Hunger Games and Divergent.
The skills that he learns is knowledge and emotions and memories. And so I take those with me as my my weapon, if you must. And so it was a very emotional film and a very deep, dark idea based on Lois's book.
The Giver is rated PG-13 for some adult themes and sci-fi violence.
So what do you think? Do you plan to see The Giver? Have you read the book?
Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter, @NowVOAShow.
Manny, do you like chocolate?
I do. I used to like white chocolate, but
yeah.
Now I'm a big fan of dark chocolate, but the sea salt kind.
The sea salt kind.
Yeah, I like it a little bit sweet and...
It's got to be a little sweet, a little salty.
Yeah.
So, my wife absolutely loves chocolate. She will, you know, the baker's chocolate, the stuff you make cake, like batter?
Like brownies?
Well, like the stuff that you put in brownies, you mix it with sugar and all kinds of stuff. Real dark.
Yeah.
Doesn't have any sugar in it.
Mm-hmm.
Girlfriend will eat it like a Hershey bar.
A Hershey bar?
Yeah. I mean, just snap off the little squares and chew on them. And I'm like, because it's real bitter. Chocolate in that stage, if it doesn't have any sugar in it, it's real bitter.
I'm not sure if I would like that.
Yeah, well, you know, it turns out, though, she might be onto something. Dark raw chocolate can be good for you. VOA's George Putich tells us how.
The biggest benefit from eating cocoa and dark chocolate may be lowered blood pressure, thanks to the almost decadent feeling of cocoa butter melting in your mouth. That mood may also contribute to chocolate's antidepressant qualities, says dietitian Kim Hoffman.
It contains phenethylamines, which is a neurotransmitter that's found in the brain and actually... acts as a mood elevator. It also enhances the blood endorphins, which are the happy opiates, and they are basically around when you're on a high.
Not all chocolate is equal when it comes to those beneficial chemicals. Some researchers say the high heat required to process commercial chocolate, up to 130 degrees centigrade, can actually lower their effectiveness. At Honest Chocolate in Cape Town, South Africa, artisan chocolatier Anthony Grid keeps the temperature of his raw chocolate below 42 degrees.
There's a movement to minimal cooking or minimal heating of food just to retain the natural antioxidants or whatever, the minerals, whatever it may be. So cocoa is part of that. You can do it raw with a very good quality bean.
In order to reduce cocoa's natural bitterness, manufacturers of chocolate products remove polyphenols, antioxidants that create the bitter taste, and add sugar. Food science writer Leonie Joubert notes that sugar is connected to weight-related illnesses and that chocolate isn't something that should be eaten every day.
The problem is that overexposure to sugar over a long period of time, it causes this repeated inflammatory response in the body, which now is linked to heart disease. Obviously, it's linked to obesity and weight problems and the associated diseases.
The confections at Honest Chocolate are made with agave nectar rather than cane sugar and have a very high percentage of cacao, something customer Jessica Bonin appreciates.
What I find quite remarkable about their chocolate is that you're not overwhelmed by the sugar, so you actually get to taste the chocolate itself, which is really so luxurious and quite decadent.
Like many other chocolate connoisseurs, Bonin satisfies her craving with just one small piece of really good chocolate. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of this report, especially if you love chocolate, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And do you love chocolate? And how do you use it? Let us know at our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Tomorrow way too far away, and we can't get back yesterday. But we young right now, we got it right now, so get up right now.
Manny, were you ever in band, like in school? Did you ever play an instrument?
Oh, gosh, no. I have zero musical talent.
Really?
How about you?
Well, I wasn't in marching band. I played bass guitar in, like, the stage band, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah, you told me about this last time.
The Johnny Carson kind of thing where they, you know, the out-of-tune horns kind of... We were terribly bad. Do you know what a bassoon is?
I know what a baboon is.
No. not a baboon. A baboon is a primate with a blue nose.
I don't know what a bassoon is.
Okay, well, it's a double reed instrument. It's not surprising because, you know, the bassoon is sometimes thought of as like the Rodney Dangerfield of the orchestra. You know, I don't get no respect. That kind of thing.
But as Gail Wine found out this month, double reed instruments like the bassoon took center stage at the International Double Reed Society Conference in New York.
Most people don't even know what a bassoon is, says IDRS president and bassoonist Keith Swegger.
First, they ask what I play, and I say bassoon, and then they usually describe an oboe. So that is typical. But I do try to say, oh, well, the grandfather from Peter and the Wolf.
This family of musical instruments gets that distinctive sound from its reed, which is made from two wafer-thin pieces of bamboo cane bound together. When the player blows into the reed, the two pieces vibrate together, just like human vocal cords do. Swegger says these instruments are at home in any genre of music.
You find double reeds in pop music, you find them in jazz, you find them all over the place, and a lot of times sprinkled in such a way that people don't even recognize that they're there, which is wonderful. But again, traditionally, we expect to see these instruments and hear them in orchestras, in chamber groups, in bands, wind ensembles.
There are generally just one or two bassoons in a symphony orchestra, compared with a dozen or more violins or cellos. Aidan Braun, a college student from New Jersey, says their common interest bonds the players.
I think there's a nice sense of community between bassoonists that doesn't really exist with necessarily all the other instruments. And I just think you have to have something, I don't know if I want to say weird, but you have to be a little eccentric to play the bassoon. And so I think that definitely brings us together.
There were 137 events crowded into the five-day conference. Participants enjoyed concerts, masterclasses, and workshops, like this one on a technique called circular breathing, led by Stephen Mershner from Melbourne, Australia.
It's like a chicken wing, all like, what are we doing? We're playing the
bagpipes.
What's our bagpipe? Guess what? Here we go. Look at me. Can everyone do that? Stop. Don't try to do anything more.
Mershner demonstrated the technique of blowing air out of your mouth while inhaling through your nose.
Doing both of those things at the same time. So the idea is that you see the person playing and they just don't stop. And I go at best probably 15 to 20 minutes.
Without
taking something you could audibly. So yeah, you can basically keep on going and going and going and going and going and going. So.
The annual gathering creates a rare opportunity for masses of instruments to perform together, like the 22 contrabassoonists of the Contraband. High school senior Dennis Bruckner was duly impressed by the concert.
I don't know that I've ever seen two together, and that was 22, so that's pretty crazy.
What'd you think of it?
It was awesome.
The instrumentalists also showed their whimsical side with a flash mob performance, taking people in New York's Washington Square Park by surprise with a rendition of New York, New York, complete with choreography and a drag queen singer. There are opportunities for everyone to make music at the International Double Reed Society Conference. And they'll do it all again next year at the 2015 conference in Tokyo, Japan. For VOA News, I'm Gail Wine in New York.
So what do you think? Have you played a double reed instrument?
Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can also email us your questions or comments at voaasia@voanews.com.
And follow us on Twitter, @NowVOAShow.
The U.S. government says that more than 6,000 people have died in the last 16 years trying to cross the U.S. border illegally from Mexico.
Yet thousands of illegal immigrants, many of them children without parents, continue to attempt the dangerous journey.
As VOA's Greg Flakes tells us now, many of these immigrants find themselves in a hostile, unforgiving environment, and many of them die.
In South Texas, this river is the border with Mexico, and it's fairly easy to cross. But once across, the undocumented immigrants find little water, heavy brush, and many small creatures with nasty bites. U.S. Border Patrol agent Jason Owens says smugglers often leave people on their own here.
You know, the guides that bring them across, if they can't keep up with the group, they leave them behind. They walk around lost, no water, no idea where they're supposed to go, no form of communication, no food. This close to the river, a lot of people can find themselves in serious trouble and die.
Owens says the human smugglers are part of a Mexican criminal world that includes drug trafficking cartels responsible for killing thousands of people.
The smuggling groups, you see infighting with the cartel fighting with the Mexican authorities who are doing their best over there to try and get control of the situation. And then they come over here, and a lot of times you have the same thing.
In South Texas, hundreds of unidentified bodies have been discovered, many dug out of the ground by a volunteer forensic team from Baylor University. Those who come from Central America are fleeing drug gang violence and poverty in countries like Honduras. On the long journey through Mexico, many are robbed and abused, including children who travel alone. Border Patrol spokesman Peter Bidegain says once they cross, the child immigrants often seek the protection of the agents and confide in them.
A lot of times when you ask them, you know, how was your journey? What was it like? They start to cry. It's very emotional. It's emotional for the agents and it's emotional for the kids.
Despite the dangers, Tony Payan says what many immigrants face at home is worse.
What we're talking about here is enormous, very deep poverty in Central America and hopelessness. And when people are hopeless, they're going to move. It's been the history of mankind.
In Texas, Border Patrol agents continue to look out for drug smugglers and for those who cross the border illegally and risk their lives in a harsh environment. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
To see video of this story, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know what you think by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we're also on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Oceans cover two-thirds of our planet.
While they appear to harbor an inexhaustible supply of food, humans have overfished and polluted the oceans with climate-changing gases that make the waters acidic and less productive.
This is the underlying theme that runs through a new book by a scientist and his novelist son called The Extreme Life of the Sea.
VOA's Roseanne Skirbel caught up with the authors at the Museum of Natural History here in Washington.
In the museum's St. Ocean Hall, images seem to pop off the pages. The authors set out to connect readers with the drama of ocean life, says Tony Palumbi, the novelist side of the duo.
By looking at the extremes of what life can do, we can sort of surmise what it is capable of in large.
Father and son dive into an ocean world filled with fantastic creatures, like the giant megalodon shark that lived 20 million years ago. Its enormous jaws have dagger-like teeth, says co-author and Stanford University scientist Steve Palumbi.
How do you grow something that's three times sharper than a razor blade? And they not only grow them, but they grow lots of them because as they get dull, they just discard them. So they grow rows of teeth in their throat, and the teeth rise up in their throat like that, and then they come out, and those are the biting teeth.
The oldest known creature on the planet is a deep-sea black coral off Hawaii that's been alive for more than 4,200 years. One of the fastest is the sailfish, which races after prey at speeds topping 60 kilometers an hour.
And they've got a 30th of a second before hitting the fish and gulping it down. Their brains have to work very fast. Their eyes have to work very fast. They have heaters on the back of their eyes. They have heaters on the tops of their brains. And by heating their eyes and brains, they can actually see and react fast enough to eat at those speeds.
These curious critters are but a sampling of the ocean's denizens, whose diversity is largely unexplored and threatened by overfishing, pollution, and climate change, say the authors. One solution is to expand marine sanctuaries that limit human activity. What's missing, says Steve Palumbi, is political will. But he says citizens can change that.
So instead of looking at this life as something that we can just take, like some sort of mine of fishes, then essentially it should be our partner in allowing the oceans to stay healthy and productive and beautiful and useful for us. So it's that partnership that we're actually trying to reestablish here.
The future of the ocean, the authors say, rests in our hands, and we must become better stewards to protect it and ourselves. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of this story, visit our webpage, www.voanews.com.
And let us know what you think by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And follow us on Twitter at Now VOA Show. Manny, have you ever sailed through the Panama Canal? You ever take a big ship, go across the oceans?
No, I haven't, but I've seen photos, and it's pretty.
Yeah.
Have you?
I've been close. I've been, like, to Belize, which is just a little bit north, but I've never been through the canal itself.
Yeah, and this year marks a special anniversary for the canal.
As VOA's Mil Arcega tells us, this is the 100th anniversary since the canal connected the Gulf of Mexico with the Pacific Ocean.
Taking over 30 years to build, tens of thousands of workers, and more than 27 million kilograms of dynamite, it's considered one of the biggest engineering feats of the 20th century. University of Maryland professor Julie Green is author of the book, The Canal Builders.
The Panama Canal is one of those phenomenal moments in history, a terrific example of engineering and technological strength of the United States, and really the coming of age of the United States as a global power.
But the work exacted a heavy toll. By the time the first ship crossed the canal, nearly 26,000 workers had died, some from accidents, many from malaria. But it also changed international commerce forever, especially in the U.S., says George Washington University professor Noel Moore on Skype.
It's because it enabled, for the first time, oil from California and lumber from the Pacific Northwest, but it was really the Californian oil that was driving the boat.
Today, more than 4% of the world's commerce passes through the canal, some 14,000 ships per year. But the canal's locks are now too small for much of the world's container fleet and the largest oil tankers. Transportation expert Rodney McFadden says bigger ships can be more efficient and more profitable.
They carry more cargo for about the same amount of money per mile. They are much easier on the environment, and they increase trade.
A Hong Kong company is backing a $40 billion plan to dig an alternate route through Nicaragua. If successful, it could pose a serious challenge to the canal. But critics say the project is redundant and impractical, especially when the Panama Canal is in the midst of a $5 billion expansion. Of the approximately 160 ports in the U.S., only about 15 can accommodate the larger supertankers that will pass through the expanded canal. By early 2016, experts say this grand canal will be able to handle 97% of the world's container ships, doubling the canal's capacity and ensuring that it remains a marvel of engineering 100 years from now. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
So what do you think? Is a new canal needed, or is the expansion enough?
Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can always email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
And follow us on Twitter at Now VOA Show.
Thanks for joining us for this Monday edition of Now.
If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
Or you can visit our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter, at Now VOA Show.
If you want to hear our show again, visit www.voanews.com/now We're also on iTunes.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao. Until tomorrow, I'm David Berg.
And I'm Manny Eck.
Join us again for another edition of Now.